All right, Steve Darnall is the editor-in-chief for Nostalgia Digest magazine. It's not a... The summer edition is not a swimsuit issue, as Don Ameche's on the cover, so we'll just assume that's not the case. But to talk about it all is Steve Darnall. Happy summer, Steve. How are you?
Lovely, David. Lovely to hear your voice again.
No swimsuit, but sexy Don Ameche on the cover. I remember last year, and some years you do the swimsuit thing, but he was kind of a local guy. He was born in Kenosha, a little north of Waukegan, where Jack Benny was born. So I kind of like the connection there.
Yes, I realized as you were talking about him that, yes, he's like yourself, a fellow who made an impact in radio in Chicago. He went to New York to study to be a professional actor on stage, and the work wasn't there. And then a friend of his named Bernardine Flynn was in Chicago, where she'd gotten work on a show called Vic and Sade.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently telegraphed him to say, come out here, there's work. And he became one of the first radio stars. I mean, you know, in an era when movie stars weren't necessarily appearing on radio, radio was making its own celebrities, and Don Ameche was one of the first, and doing a lot of shows, soap operas, and dramatic series emanating from Chicago.
I will tell you what I always learn from Nostalgia Digest is something I did not know, and I see that through the whole thing. And we always just touch upon the articles because you got to get the magazine folks to get it all. But, you know, if you said Don Ameche to me, I would say, well, star of stage and screen, and might know him some... Some my generation know him from Trading Places with Eddie Murphy.
Oh, sure.
Or Cocoon, right? Exactly. But I had no idea that he was on radio. Was he more of a variety show? Was he playing an actor in shows? What was Don doing?
Well, a little bit of everything. He became famous on radio as a sort of master of ceremonies because he was, I think once he became a movie star, of course, he was very much in demand.
Sure.
And knowing how great radio was, he came back to it every chance he got. So he was the MC for the Chase and Sanborn Hour when Edgar yeah. Bergen and Charlie McCarthy were on that. And you asked what he did, and actually that's the answer can be summed up by that show, because he was the master of ceremonies, so he'd be the one to banter with Charlie McCarthy, he'd be the one to introduce a singer like Nelson Eddy, but he was also in a very notorious sketch that was on that show, set in the Garden of Eden, in which Mae West played Eve.
Oh, okay.
And
wow.
Don Ameche played Adam. And it's one of those things that you look back and you think, well, I don't know what the problem is here necessarily, but in 1937, it raised an absolute uproar, and Don Ameche somehow thankfully emerged unscathed.
I love it. Yeah.
But yeah, then of course he went on to play John Bickerson opposite Francis Langford on different shows. So and then of course, yeah, when opportunities arose like the Lux Radio Theater, he'd go on there and do dramatic work or whatever they needed from him.
And usually you don't realize that when someone's a big star in the movies or maybe later in television, that so many of these people got their starts. Yeah, they're starting radio,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
it's true. You watch, I mean, even you watch the Andy Griffith Show or the Dick Van Dyke Show, and you'll see a name and you realize, oh my God, well, these people have been working for 20 years, and that was radio. Yeah.
Let's talk about Burma Shave. I know you talk about the ads, and I want to talk about this because, you know, classic advertising. I have these encyclopedias of advertising that went to the early 1900s to the 2000s. Oh. I love these. And, you know, some of those classic ads of the 20s and the 30s, you know, first of all, Burma Shave isn't really around. I think it resurged some years ago, but it was a brushless shaving cream. The company started about 100 years ago, but it was these roadside billboards, and specifically along Route 66, that got people's attention because they were kind of ahead of their time and written so well, witty and funny.
Absolutely. It's one of those things, as you point out, you realize that the things we take for granted in broadcasting and advertising, those started from humbler origins. And in the 1920s, no one had had the idea that, I mean, people had had the idea of billboards to promote products, but the idea that you would create something specifically to entertain motorists at a time when, yes, more and more people were enjoying greater mobility thanks to the automobile and to the highways. Obviously, we didn't have the interstate highways that we know today, but it was still possible to drive across the country by automobile, and you're right, to have these little signs to promote your product, that was one thing, but to do them in rhyming verse, that was a genuine innovation. And of course, people would look forward to seeing them by the roadside, and how many billboards can say that?
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. Well, you know, and plus that's a roadside ad. You know what I love is driving through. I was just in New York a couple weeks ago, but like more rural New York, Jamestown, and a little bit of Buffalo, and then the city itself. But I love when these ads pop up when a building is torn down, and in between, like they've been hidden for years. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, yeah. I do. In Chicago, we've had a bunch of those, too, that something gets torn down and you realize, oh, my goodness, this was used to advertise some clothing firm.
Yeah.
It's great.
It is great. And there's still some around downtown. If you're in a skyscraper down here and you see an older building, like, off to the side that you couldn't see off the street, you still see those. There was a bar that was built in my neighborhood some years ago, and it was a very old building that they knocked down and needed to go. But when it came down, there was a Coca-Cola ad on one side and a bread that no longer exists on the other. And I just feel like it's probably lead paint, so it really wasn't going away anytime soon. But I just find it fascinating to see some old ads, and really I love doing a little background on them and figuring out what is the history behind the product or the graphic or the sign or the advertising campaign itself. And that Burma Shave stuff was just great. I mean, it was funny, some of the stuff that they wrote, kind of ahead of its time.
Yeah, in fact, I'm trying to think out loud. In I think the South Loop, there are a few places like that. There was something for a corset company or something like, or Hobbies Magazine.
Oh, that's cool.
And down around 10,000, about 1,000 South Michigan, I think.
Nostalgia Digest Magazine, 1 year subscription is $19, 2 years is $34, 4 issues a year, 64 pages. You can subscribe at nostalgiadigest.com. And there's more with Steve after this on 720 WGN. Brothers, there's an article in here about Harpo, so you didn't hear Harpo on that little clip, naturally. But, you know, Harpo Marx, really interesting guy. I mean, really interesting guy. And you feature him in some background about him that most people probably don't know.
That's true. We had a lovely article submitted to us, which is in this issue, about Harpo in the wake of Duck Soup finding himself appointed as a goodwill ambassador to the relatively newly formed country of Russia.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, in a way, I mean, he considered himself apolitical in many respects, so he couldn't figure out why this was happening. But in retrospect, it makes perfect sense, because here's somebody who was not worried about a language barrier at all.
Right.
So he could go overseas and be part of a review and do some of his clowning and play the harp, things he loved to do. And then, of course, he also found himself in an unusual position as he prepared to come home.
Well, I mean, it would be easy for him. He was a talented mime. So, you know, you could always communicate through gestures and so forth, which I'm sure he did. His real name was Adolf, which was not popular in the 30s and 40s. changed his name to Arthur. He was a skilled harpist. Like, that just wasn't a prop. I mean, he really knew how to play.
He really did, and it's funny because when I was young, of course, the Marx Brothers films were on television, and of course, you fall in love with the clowning and the repartee, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And when they'd stop for a harp solo, you know, when you're young, you just think, oh, we're just killing the momentum here, but you know what? He was so beautiful, and to watch him play the harp in those films is really quite wonderful, because he would not necessarily have told you he was a virtuoso, although he was very, very good. But there's just this wonderful, serene look that comes over his face.
Yeah.
And I know there's a marvelous song about that. Jonathan Richman, the songwriter, wrote a song called When Harpo Plays His Harp. And it's just beautiful. So, yeah, I mean, one of the things about a publication like this, David, is that we're hopefully finding things that, despite being decades old, might still have some resonance with people in the present. You know, art is one of those things that once you put it out there, it's out there, and it may make sense at the moment, and it may make sense 100 years from now. And thankfully, Harpo Marx is pretty timeless.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's, of course, a lot more in the digest. Linda Darnell, she's not an ex-wife, Steve, or an aunt or anything. No relation,
no,
right?
No,
just different spelling.
I have been told we are distantly related.
So. No way.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Who's Linda Darnell?
Linda Darnell was an actress. I guess if I believe the story, she's a very, very distant cousin of mine. But that's not why we put her story in the magazine,
right,
David.
Right.
I'm not guided by nepotism.
okay, good to hear.
But no, she was actually a really strikingly attractive young woman who went out to Hollywood, and I mean, really in her teens, I think 15 or 16 years old, she had a movie contract and was playing, leading parts, and went on to do a number of films that are at least known by people who know the films of the period. I'm thinking of, you know, Hangover Square and Fallen Angel with Dana Andrews and Alice Faye and A Letter to Three Wives. We had an article, a piece about her very early career and her road to success. And one of the things that's great fun in the digest is when we find something that was written at the time. You know, we don't, mm-hmm. as a rule, rely on reprints from other publications, but back in the 1940s, the movie studios were sending out loads of little kits so that any newspaper in America could have the true story, purportedly, of how this person
became
a star.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And so, you know, it's great to put the spotlight on people who otherwise, you know, maybe don't get articles written about them all that often.
Love it. I really enjoyed the story of the great comedy minds because there are so many of them. And when you think about, you know, over time in the movies and television and everywhere else, you know, you might have your favorites in mind, but there were a lot that were unexpectedly really funny people.
Yes, and obviously comedy is subjective, but I think one of the things that article did was, you know, put the spotlight on some people who, pardon me, who were very, very in demand at a time when slapstick was still
the thing,
pretty acceptable.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think nowadays, for whatever reason, we downplay that. You know, I think, I mean, where there are still Jerry Lewis's and Jim Carrey's,
mm-hmm.
but right, I think more people tend to rely on visual or verb, not on visual, but on verbal humor, and that's fine. But yeah, it was great to be reminded that there was a time when, yes, there were people who weren't ashamed to do broad comedy, and some of them really did it beautifully. I mean, Frank Tashlin, my goodness, who is, he started out as an animator, and then he became a writer, and then he became a director, and he made The Girl Can't Help It, which is one of the, for my money, one of the funniest films of the 1950s,
sure.
with Jane Mansfield, and also a favorite film of the Beatles, because it presented performances by Little Richard and Eddie Cochran and the Platters.
You know, you talk about physical comedy and seeing people's expressions. That wasn't what radio was all about. I mean, how creative and how you know, high level did you have to be to do comedy on radio when you couldn't see anything?
That's true. Radio comedy required a skill set from writers and performers both that otherwise hadn't been really an issue. Because obviously you're right. If you come on a stage or you're on a screen, yes, you can do a pratfall. You can, you know, make a gesture. You can make a funny face. Radio, you can't do any of that. None of that helps you at all. You're reliant on your sound and your voices and sound effects.
And your timing.
And timing, yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously, people like Jack Benny are so great in that regard because he learned you could do just as much by not speaking as by speaking. And of course, yes, and you, to come back to Don Ameche, you know, he worked with Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a ventriloquist on radio.
Yeah,
and yet no one is listening to him thinking, oh, that's clearly a ventriloquist.
Yeah, no, not at
you
all.
You're just listening to the comedy, and You're right. They did some great comedy in those days, and every week on our shows we get to spotlight at least some of it, and that's really gratifying to know that some of it, well, like anything we cover, it's hopefully it's still funny or moving or tuneful as it was 70 and 80 years ago. And even the stuff that isn't still tells you something about the time in which it was created.
You know, we started the conversation talking about nostalgia and how important that is from back in the day, some of it before our time. But I read this article a few days ago I wanted to share with you. Nostalgia is having a moment, and it's not showing any signs of slowing down. It's comfort food to look back at simpler times. But here's the era that they were talking about. This is on social media.
Oh, God, okay.
It's not the 40s or 70s or 80s. From vintage fashion and Y2K makeup to the seemingly endless remakes and reboots of films and TV shows, the mainstream media has fully embraced the past to the present, very focused on the 2000s.
What is the... There's a famous saying, nostalgia isn't what it used to be.
It is not.
You know, it's interesting, though. I'll say this, that there has been, I guess, actual scientific data indicating that nostalgia is beneficial.
Sure.
There was a study in the UK some years ago, which I absolutely loved about, because I guess, obviously, yes, in troubled times, it gives you something of a balm, something that lets you think back to a better time. And I guess, in turn, it makes you more likely to get into new things, to pursue new adventures, on the premise that one day you'll have a story to tell.
Nostalgia Digest Magazine, the summer edition, not the swimsuit edition, the summer edition is out now. 1 year subscription is $19, 2 years is $34, four issues a year, 64 pages. It's great stuff, folks. You can subscribe at nostalgiadigest.com. Steve, thanks for joining us once again, and enjoy the rest of your summer, pal.
And David, the same to you. Thank you for your hospitality.
Thank you. All right, top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom are next.